everyone. My name is Emma. I am the host today for Right On Radio. Today's my special guest today is Stacey Carlson and her newly released book, The Gyre. Thank you so much for coming into this for today, Stacey.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So can you just give an overview of the book, just like a quick little summary for our listeners at home?
Sure. Yes. This novel, I think of it as a love letter to the far northern wilderness. It's literary historical fiction, and the novel traces the story of a Russian Orthodox monk who wants to be the northernmost holy man in the world. So it's a story of, you know, spoiler alert, failed ambitions and questionable motives.
Yeah.
And a transformative journey by foot that he makes. He walks up the coastline of a rugged Arctic environment and encounters many adventures and many entities that are inhabiting the place.
I'm kind of curious, what made you think about writing specifically an Orthodox Russian monk specifically? Like, what kind of gravitated you towards that?
Sure. Yeah, that question is a Pandora's box, honestly, because like most creative ideas, the whole idea for this book, including the main character, is just a combination, a mosaic of factors from my life. So I've always loved the far north. I grew up in Seattle and had some early formative experiences in Alaska. So long story short, when I finished my last book, I knew I wanted to set a story set in the wilderness, and but I didn't want to use Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It was too familiar and didn't captivate me. So eventually I landed on Svalbard, mm-hmm. which at the time that the book is set is called Spitsbergen. So you'll hear me use those two mm-hmm. names interchangeably. And once I started diving into the cultural history of Svalbard, I was really, I fell in love with the Russian presence there over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a subculture, a Russian sort of ethnic group from the White Sea mm-hmm. called the Pomors. And they have a long history of being in Svalbard as hunters, seafarers. And there's just some wonderful things that I learned about them. So from that point, mm-hmm. I decided to start on the religious end of the spectrum with the character so that I had a lot of room for him to move into or out of his upbringing.
Yeah. I was always like, I love like kind of the blend of the Slavic folkloric myths along with the more, I guess I want to say more contemporary Orthodox Christian beliefs and like the wrestling between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved the research that went into this. Can you describe a little bit more about what was like something fun that you learned about while writing through a historical fiction book like this?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of my touchstones and guiding lights mm-hmm. for my research and that is entwined in the story was this almanac that I mm-hmm. found. I actually found like an old 19th century hard copy of this book among the stacks of my local university library. And it was an almanac of Russian folklore of the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the book, you'll see that in my main character's memories and the stuff that he thinks about while he's on his journey reflect this Russian countryside.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like seasonal markers. And in this book, it was like, you know, if the crows are flying east on March 13th, you'll have a windy spring, like stuff like
yeah.
that. And I loved that. And I loved learning about another culture and kind of falling in love with it. And so I brought a lot of that into some of my characters and their memories and things like that.
I loved the kind of I love like stories of like man goes out into wilderness specifically because of like I guess I just really like The Revenant too. Was that like also a big inspiration?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I am a huge fan of man goes out to wilderness, finds out the wilderness is just not what it's cracked up to be, and like kind of this deromanticization, but like still fighting through like things like that. So what other inspirations? I'm guessing The Revenant was a big one.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. And what I really enjoyed, one of the themes that I was most excited to explore as an artist was turning around that man versus nature paradigm that you see so often whether it's the literature of exploration, mm-hmm. Or even something like The Revenant, which I do love that. You know, The Grievous Injury does make an appearance in my book. But one of the things that became really important to the book mm-hmm. is presenting kind of a sentient world. Mm-hmm. I've started to think about it a little bit that way, where instead of desolation, loneliness even, the world I wanted to create, the wilderness world that I wanted to create, is full of beings mm-hmm. and especially full of stories. And so as he gets deeper and deeper into the wilderness, my job as an artist, I felt, was to really show how not alone he was.
Yeah.
Whether it's showing a little glimpse of the inner life of a seabird or an mm-hmm. Arctic fox, like they have stories, or some of the Slavic folklore that I chose to present of stories and beings that were intertwined with the land.
I'm curious about, mostly when it comes to like your writing process and like maybe some of the previous work, like what of your previous work have you done that has inspired this book specifically? Or it's like, oh, based off of this passive work I've done here, I want to do something different for this one.
Yeah, it's definitely the latter. My first published book is called Among the Wonderful, mm-hmm. and it's set in mid-19th century. Again, there must be something about that time from past life.
Yeah.
But it's set in New York City, mm-hmm. and it's set almost entirely inside this huge labyrinthine building. Mm-hmm. So very much an indoor book, although one of my main characters has a significant journey on foot as well. Mm-hmm. I kind of just put that together recently, but it's in like undeveloped Upper Manhattan, which is super fun. I mean, I don't know if you can tell, but research is kind of a twin passion for me, and it ignites my imagination. But so anyway, when I finished that book, as I said earlier, I knew I wanted to do something set almost mm-hmm. entirely outside.
Yeah.
So I think it was kind of that tension and contrast that influenced this book quite a bit. I also knew that I wanted to have a folklore-infused mm-hmm. book, and the story would kind of be hung on this archetypal framework of, okay, maybe it's the hero's journey, but more specifically, there's a Russian story called mm-hmm. Ivan the Fool, which is about, you know, Ivan's the third brother, he's the weakest, he's the stupidest, he's the laziest, so he goes on all these adventures, and somehow, through stubbornness or luck, fortune kind of smiles on him. Mm-hmm. And so my character was very much inspired by that archetype.
What other Slavic folkloric tales that were like, oh, I have to input this into my book? Mm-hmm. Do you have any ones in specifically that stood out? Or like ones that were like, oh, this is kind of interesting.
Well, I definitely wanted to use Baba Yaga, but she's so associated with the forest.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm in an Arctic, my story's in an Arctic landscape. So I was like, dang it, I can't use her. Well, there's one that really haunted me that's in the book, primarily experienced by another, I would say, primary character, this woman named Saskia.
Yeah.
And it's this being called Chudo Yuda.
Mm-hmm.
And they live in the sea and kind of reach out, kind of that, I don't want to say siren-y type of luring, but a powerful entity in the deep that will, I mean, basically destroy you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some of my early research before I really settled on Svalbard also included a little bit of Inuit culture mm-hmm. and cosmology, which is just an incredibly beautiful and interesting path to go down. And similarly, there's kind of similar folkloric being within that under the sea, kind of feminized and part of some creation stories as well. So,
was this book always going to be set in Svalbard, or did you have like other contenders?
Always Svalbard.
It was always Svalbard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sort of why of that, again, I get a little bit lost in that question because it's weirdly kaleidoscopic, all the different factors that led me to choose Svalbard. But I guess I'll just say, two things. One is that it was just so fascinating to me when I first started learning about Svalbard, because I was like, I don't know anything about this place. Okay. And that's on me, but I think it was a little bit widespread. Like my friends, like, where the heck is that? And so I thought, gosh, in 2013 or wherever I started writing this book, it's amazing this day and age where we have like all this information at our fingertips that there's this place that I'm just like, it's just a void. Like, I don't know anything about it. Again, that's on me. A lot of people know a lot about Svalbard, but it was one of the igniting curiosities that led to kind of an obsession about the place.
I really like, I know when I Google Svalbard, like the first thing I think of is like, oh, the people that live there have to have guns because of the prevalent polar bear.
Yes.
And I'm like, what kind of place? It seems almost otherworldly because it is like the most northern residential, like, for like a sustaining population of people, right?
Yes.
From my understanding, that's like, you know, people don't really live in the Arctic outside of researchers.
There are a lot of people who live there that, who are not researchers.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's exactly what you said. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many fascinating facets of Svalbard. Its largest town includes a school for northern wilderness guides.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I actually had the opportunity to go to Svalbard on an artist residency program, which I can tell you a little bit more about if we have time. But so when you go to this town, there's all these really awesome, at least awesome looking people who are coming in and out of that guiding school, let me tell you, as well as researchers and things like that. So there's guiding school. There's a bit of a tourist industry. There's a whole Russian coal mining town that's still operating. That's like this incredibly strange time capsule.
Oh, really?
Especially to Western eyes like mine, it's literally a coal mining town. It has kind of a penal colony vibe, honestly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then north of all that is New Alesund, which is a group of international scientists who are, you know, actively working on sort of quantifying the consequences of climate change.
I'm curious to learn more about this artist residency. Did that also, was that like the bit when you were there, you're like, oh, I'm going to write this book? Strangely enough, vice versa.
Oh, I had been writing the book for a couple of years when a friend of mine emailed me like, hey, you should do this.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. And then a link. And lo and behold, it's this residency called the Arctic Circle. And every year they take about 25 artists up and they sail up the coast of Svalbard. Essentially the path, I think it varies each year, but essentially the path that my main character walks.
Yeah.
So I had the truly unique opportunity to have written a rough draft and then go to the place that my imagination had already conjured, which was, I mean, it was amazing.
That explains a lot of the landscape prose, quite frankly. It was like, oh, it feels like I'm actually transported into this area. What about the Arctic landscape specifically kind of captivates you, I think, is a good question.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think with Svalbard specifically, although I will say the Arctic landscape, really its vastness and the scale of its geology and topography, in the sense of, okay, yeah, it's really open, no trees really obscuring anything. And just, I think what captivates me the most is, honestly, the biodiversity and the disconnect between what you think of when you think of the far north, maybe windswept or snow-swept desolation, and what you encounter when you actually go there in the summer or spring, which is, you know, tundra ecosystems, moss, lots of flowers, and lots of birds and animals. So I think that biodiversity is part of what captures my imagination.
I think of, well, Arctic tundras, I think they're technically deserts because there's like a precipitation level. And so I think of deserts as well as like a landscape that people think is like desolate, but in like a big picture sense, but when you narrow it down, it's absolutely beautiful and gorgeous.
Exactly.
So that's the first thing I think of. Yeah. So what kind of other artists or either writers, painters that you were thinking of while conjuring up this book, either contemporary or past?
Oh, wow. Can we open it to any kind of artists?
Oh, yeah, any kind.
Well, there are a couple of musicians that actually deeply influenced me. And one is the Faroese singer-songwriter Ivor. Her work is amazing. It's in a lot of it is in Faroese, and the language, while not of Svalbard, it's definitely of the far north, and it just contains this resonance that I feel is really beautifully connected to my work. Her songs are kind of witchy, and that also just I don't know that aspect I really love. So Ivor's music for sure. There are a couple of artists that I met through the Arctic Circle residency. One is a painter named Cedra Wood. Mm-hmm. She's based in New Mexico, and her body of work, I consider her a kindred spirit. She's also a friend of mine. But if you look up her work, you'll see elements of folklore and a love of making the process of art making visible, whether it's photographs that go with a painting to show some of her interesting process. When she was on the residency, she braided her hair into some of the rigging of the ship that we were on.
What?
Yeah, we were on like a Dutch tall ship, so this schooner.
Yeah.
And so like very embodied. I guess you can't get more embodied than that.
Really.
I could go on, but maybe, there's a lot of artists whose work has influenced this book. Yeah.
What kind of other books are you planning on in the future? Do you have anything on deck, so to speak?
Yeah, a couple. One is in the works, another novel, and also set in the 19th century. So again, making me scratch my head about that. You know, I think it's true. There was a quote I read years ago, which I don't remember the source, but it's like, it was something about the 19th century being a crooked mirror that the current times holds up to itself, because so many of our modern industries and technologies were born then. And actually, the book that I'm working on has to do with something specifically related to that, because it's about early photography. One of the characters obsessed with photography.
Oh.
So early cameras and image making is one of the hearts of that work. I'm also working on a book where it's entirely different, where I'm the editor, and it's a collection, a compendium of nonfiction essays written by herbalists.
Oh.
So, herbal medicine is something I also practice as a home herbalist. And I'm in the process of putting the initial stages of that together.
I'm curious about the herbal medicine too. It is like, are you just a big fan of plants and like that also kind of ties into your love of nature?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Good observation. It's very connected. Mm-hmm. I think most of my writing comes from, obviously a very personal space, and in that sort of inner altar for me, nature connection and my own experiences in the wild have a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everything I write has some connection with a deep connection with a landscape, at the very least.
I also noticed when you were talking about your love of like 19th century research, I think it's like, you just like the work of research itself is like its own kind of process, and that's maybe do you think that's why you stick to like mostly 19th century?
Maybe actually. Right, because I have little interest in writing about the current time.
Yeah.
Very little. And so, yes, I think it's a twin passion.
Yeah.
And I didn't really realize it as such until I'm like, wait, another book idea set in the 19th century.
Because there's like this love of like scientists, artists who love the work of research or like the discovery of learning something new. Because if I sat and write down a fiction book about contemporary America, it's like, well, I already know like the setting. And it's like, oh, I want to delve into the clothes and really put myself into, like, transport myself into a different realm. I don't know
absolutely. Yeah. Like, I remember actually in my first book, like I said, it was set mostly indoors.
Yeah.
And so I just went down a rabbit hole, months of figuring out, like, what all the lighting would be, and what wouldn't sound too clunky to refer to, because light switch is so easy, but they didn't really have those then. So, but I love that. I love those rabbit holes and, just things like that.
One of the things, last question before I ask you to read a nice excerpt is the food was like kind of the thing I was kind of obsessed with. Can you tell us like how you research into the food of the book?
I have to say, yep. highly recommend writing a book in which your character starves because of this. Exactly.
Yeah.
It was so satisfying yeah. to research the food that he would be dreaming of.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that one of the catalysts for that research is this episode of the Netflix series Chef's Table.
Oh.
In, I think it's the first season. There's okay. a wonderful Russian chef, this guy in Moscow. He mm-hmm. has this fancy restaurant. It's looks really cool. But he, a lot of that episode was about his journey to find pre-Soviet era mm-hmm. recipes, you know, that weren't as easy to come by anymore. And he listed off just in like 5 minutes of that episode, you know, I was writing all these notes yeah. and he listed off 5 or 6 either books or specific recipes
yeah.
where I was just like, oh, I got to research that. And one of them was apparently moose lips were oh. a delicacy. Trigger warning,
yeah.
moose lips. yeah. And, but I was just sure. like, I could not. I was like, I have to, if not that, like some other. Well, anyway,
yeah.
I was like, I got to look into that.
Yeah.
So then it was also just imagining what it would be like to yeah. be obsessing over, if you were yeah. if you were starving,
yeah.
to be obsessing over portions left half-eaten
yeah.
And what that would be, what the smells and specific tastes
yeah.
might, you might be, you know, thinking about a lot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Stacy. And now she's going to read an excerpt from her book.
Chapter 1, 1860, The White Sea. Arkady Afanasyev opens his eyes to stinging rain. He pitches to one side, and the rope that binds him digs under his ribs and pulls at his shoulder sockets. In the time his eyes were closed, the sea has dulled from gray to black, and the morning light, however wan, has died. Beyond the icy rivulets streaming down his face, the lights of Solovetsky Monastery recede, as if the known world were rolling off the horizon on a mechanical spool that in its place spits forth a widening void. You who are always becoming and becoming, who can never be fixed at a single point, anchor me or I'll spin away forever, Arkady whispers into the gale. The wave that wrecks the worthiest ship has only a teacup of your strength. The voices of men rise from below deck, singing some infernal shanty. In the back of his throat, Arkady tastes the last meal from the monastery kitchen, salt cod and cooked grain eaten from a bowl at the kitchen hearth. The memory soothes him until the waves jerk the loggia, his equilibrium jumps to starboard, and he vomits. His resolve also loosens, but it's too late to go back. It's far too late for that. I desire nothing but to walk the path you've set before me, Arkady shouts. Only by giving up this filth within and without do I truly become yours. He smiles through the slick fluid on his chin. Behind him, a hatch flies open. Ah, the priest! The voice rumbles like two stones knocking together. If this creature falls overboard, he'll sink straight to hell. What are you screaming about? Enjoying some sweet salt air? The voice roars. You're a sea dog. Why didn't you say so? Won't you come below? Yevgeny's got his drum, and we're sailing across worlds, little priest. We're sailing on Starostin's wings. Standing at the rail, the man lists badly to port, counterbalanced by the heavy-cut glass bottle in his hand. He's an old Pomor, born on the White Sea and raised to pursue exactly this frightful journey north. He's a great tangle of leather, silver hair, buckles, and grime. We're all lost, aren't we? The Pomor confronts the sea. Spitsbergen's cursing us back to the forest. The man raises the bottle above his mangy head. But not yet, he says. I'll not yet be imprisoned. The island will bear enough hides for one more season. He addresses a place in the sky where, if they were still at Solovetsky, sunlight would be illuminating the island's many stones, lichen-scarred faces set into walls, quartz-threaded boulders scattered in wild meadows, and farthest away from the monks, where they can be most easily ignored, stones arranged in spirals long ago by pagan hands. "I'll not cut trees for some mainland fool," cries the Pamor. "I'm free, and I always will be, even if the world is not." Arkady has been tied to the mast because of a belief among the Pamors that a man on his first voyage out of the White Sea is in grave danger. At the prospect of the vast northern ocean and perilous hunting grounds beyond, the untested man's soul is so frightened that it abandons the body, returns to the mainland, and leaves the Pamors with one less hunter for the season. But wouldn't Arkady's soul be just as able to leave him if he were below deck? The truth is he was tied there for the amusement of the men, and in turn forced to see God in wind patterns. And what better vocation is there on earth, he thinks. Suddenly the old Pamor jumps up, listening. "Feel that? Feel the pull, little priest? We've reached the straits." Arkady feels nothing. "I am not a priest," he said. "We're onto the straits at last." The Pamor grins like a child and swerves astern to embrace the helmsman. Then he goes below, dragging his fate behind him.
Thank you so much, Stacy, for that excerpt. All right. Thank you again, Stacy Carlson, and her newly released book, The Gyre, out now. Thank you again for coming on to the show tonight.
Thank you.